If you missed crypto news, I put it up on the blog. You can link up to that at coasttocoastam.com. It also has crypto news from last night. And not a whole lot going on, by the way, crypto news-wise. But then there's some other funny stuff on the blog if you want to take a look at it, coasttocoastam.com, and just click onto the icon in the lower left-hand corner of the screen. And I got a Christmas wish. I was allowed to pick somebody that I could just talk to just for the fun of it. And I was asked if there was anybody that we could just grab just, you know, for the season, who would it be? And I said, you know, it's just been so long since I've talked with Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. I said, find out whatever they're up to and see if they want to come on the air and talk about it. And my Christmas wish was granted early. They're coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, as I talked about back in February of 2006, the last time that Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince were on, I first read their research on their Turin Shroud book, which I enjoyed very much, and then followed it up with other books that they've done since. No big surprise to me that they would be honored with a little cameo shot in the Da Vinci Code movie, and it's coming up on 2 years since you were last on the show. Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince live from England. Is that where we're catching up with you?
Yeah, London, England. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Hello, Ian. I must say, I have never been a Christmas wish before, so I'm terribly honored.
Well, you don't know that. You see, you don't know who's wished for you in the past. You just know you've never granted it before. Okay, so.
But you know what they say about wishes, don't you, Ian?
Yeah. Well, see, but this is why I remember. You know, I was thinking about you all the other day. And I it was actually when the Da Vinci Code was showing on cable again the other day, so I was catching part of it, and I saw your little cameo bit on the bus, right? And I thought that was fun, and then I thought, well, the last time we had them on the show, they said they were working on these new and exciting things that they couldn't tell us about yet. And then it occurred to me, I never followed up to find out what those things were. So that's why I grabbed you, not just to talk about the things you've done, but the things that you're working on. But I assume Scion Revelation still in print and people can buy a copy of that.
Yep.
Okay. Both sides of the Atlantic. Yeah.
Now, talk a little bit about, before we move forward, talk a little bit about that particular book and what the feedback has been to your research on that book since it's been published.
It's been interesting. It came out, it must have been a couple of months after we spoke, which is probably why we couldn't go into a lot of detail about it at the time. But it's this book about the Priory of Sion, which is the secret society that's at the center of the Da Vinci Code novel and film, and of course is a real secret society. Dan Brown didn't invent it, but it's one that's surrounded with a lot of controversy about whether it's a real all-powerful secret society that runs just about everything in the world, or whether it was just a hoax by a couple of French guys and their dog back in the 1960s. So we wrote this book that was trying to sort of cut away through that, through the myths on both sides, because on one side you had a lot of people that accepted everything about the Priory of Sion, you know, almost without questioning, mainly this idea that they're the guardians of Jesus's bloodline. On the other hand, you've got the kind of mainstream media that just dismissed the whole thing as a hoax, equally credulously, without thinking about it. So we wrote the book to. We've been researching this society for a long, long time. Da Vinci Code gave us a chance to put together all the things that we'd found out about it. And the conclusion that we really came to was that it's not what it says it is, but it's not just a hoax. It's actually a front. It's a cover. It's part of, like, a misinformation exercise being put out by other secret societies. And so we put it together into Sion Revelation, which is, you know, a fairly chunky book. There was a lot that needed to be said. Reactions to it have been, as we expected, kind of mixed, in the sense that Lynn and I always seem to get in this position where we're in the middle between two sides, which means that, in a way, we catch flack from both sides from not saying, you know, we don't think that the Priory of Sion is the guardians of Jesus' bloodline, We think it was invented in the 1950s. So on the one hand, you've got all the kind of fans of the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail jumping up and saying, no, you know, you must be wrong. This can't be so.
Right.
On the other hand, we're saying there's a lot. It is important. There's a lot more to it than a simple hoax, which of course isn't what the mainstream media wants us to say. So we kind of get the flak from both sides. But you know, we've also had a lot of positive feedback from people that have read it and have, you know, followed our arguments, seen what our evidence is, and you know, gone along with it or come back with questions. So it was, you know, we knew we weren't writing a book that's going to tap into you know, people's expectations, but that's what we like to do. You know, we like to kind of throw in some questions to both sides of the argument. You know, the skeptic and the you know, the, you know, maybe the kind of too credulous believer.
Right.
So we think, you know, it's done the job that we set out to do, and it's, you know, it's selling well. People are reading it, people are discussing it, which as authors is all that we really ask for and all we set out to do.
And yet then I think that is a difficult position to be in, because you're arguing for its existence, but you're not following any of the sort of the well-worn paths that the priori of Sion conversation has gone down before. You're sort of trailblazing this new area. Did people come forward to you after the book came out with evidence that supported your theory that it is a real organization, but it's an intentionally it's an organization that intentionally sort of misleads people from believing what it really is? I mean, have you gotten any more verification on your theory since the book came out?
To a degree, that there has been some new information coming forward, particularly about, you know, the whole Rennes Le Chateau mystery, that I guess you and a lot of your readers will be familiar with, which has tended to sort of go down the path that we put out in Sion Revelation, that again it's a genuine mystery, but it's been kind of manipulated in order to divert people from what's really going on. The whole kind of link between what was going on in Rennes Le Chateau and ancient mysteries to do with ancient bloodlines was a diversion to sort of steer people away from that. You know, which is exactly what you'd expect a secret society that knew what was going on there and was following its trails to do.
Well, then explain then what again, for people who didn't catch it, what really went on at the place known as Rennes Le Chateau, visited now, I understand, by like 100,000 people a year, thanks to all of these publications, yours included, which highlighted the work of this one priest who went from total obscurity out in was it southeastern France, to have all of this money to work with to renovate the church and eventually, you know, be extremely powerful in the area.
Well, I mean, the thing is that he became very rich. He didn't become sort of powerful in the sense that we understand it. In fact, he lost a lot of power in the neighborhood, if you like, because after a while, anyway, the local bishop really thought, what on earth's going on here? You know, he was in trouble. He was actually, at one point, he was told, you know, don't stand up and give any more sermons. You're not allowed in your own church. So he kind of lost power in the normal sense, in the sense of, you know, being a priest of the Catholic Church. But he gained, as you say, an enormous amount of money. And, of course, the big question, the big mystery, is where did he get the money from? Or, indeed, how did he get the money? And you can only really go by the fact. I mean, there are some very wild theories out there. But, I mean, one of the major things about the Saunier mystery, the priest called Saunier, François Béranger Saunier, and this took place at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, as you say, in south of France. I mean, basically, this priest, you know, poor as a church mouse, they all were, certainly in that neighborhood. The area is very poor to this day. And you know, quite suddenly, he came into millions of francs. I mean, millions of francs. And, I mean, the amount has been slightly exaggerated over the years, but not much. I mean, you know, we did another count on it, and, you know, he had a lot of money, certainly for a priest. But the important thing to us is not that he was suddenly wealthy, is that he actually attracted, for some reason, which remains largely mysterious, he attracted the great and the good, not necessarily the good, the great, to his little remote hilltop village from Paris or from even further afield, including a Habsburg Archduke. And some, you know, great people from Paris, such as the famous opera singer Emma Calvey. Now, why? You know, why did he do this? One reason might be, and I think this is rather obvious, is that Saunier was virulently a monarchist, and of course France's Republic. And he would stand up at election time in the pulpit and actually use the pulpit as a political platform and say, come on, vote for the monarchists. So that would explain to some extent, perhaps, why a Habsburg Archduke would turn up there, although I don't think it would cover everything.
Yeah, very interesting. So in the end, what is it that you think he had? I mean, the story is that he, you know, we all heard about him uncovering the bloodline of Jesus and that he knew the name of the Holy Grail, and it was not a thing. It was a baby, and it was the inheritors of the sacred blood of Christ. But you don't believe that?
Well, there's no evidence for it.
Yeah.
There's no reason to believe it.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just a lot of rumors and speculation, that.
So what did you get from the book, or where else are you being confirmed about what it was that he actually did have?
What we think was happening, when we round that out, we don't have a complete answer to what Saunier was about. And in terms of the book, Zion Revelation, it's you know, we only deal with that in as much as what it tells us about the Priory of Zion and its activities. But what we think Saunier was doing, he was looking for information, documents that had belonged to the noble family that had kind of owned the village. Up until the time of the French Revolution, which was, you know, about 100 years before Saunier's time, there are references to them having some kind of secret documents. And it really looks like Saunier and his brother, who's equally important in this, who is also a priest, were trying to find something that was known to have been in this family's archives up until the Revolution, but had disappeared since. So he was taking the opportunity to have a look around. And it was... what the information is, we don't know, because the document's missing, and if Saunier found it, it's gone into you know, private hands. But there were certainly very strong connections between that family and other families that the Saunier brothers were researching, and certain types of sort of more esoteric Freemasonry that had developed during the 18th century in France and other places in Europe. So it seems to have been some document to do with these societies. So whatever the great secret that this gave away is, we don't know. But we do think that the whole notion it was to do with the survival of a bloodline, which was a notion that really came up in the 1960s. See, from Saunier's death until the late 50s, nobody paid much attention to this mystery. And then in the late 50s, it started getting a lot of publicity in France, and people started making TV programs about it. And what you found at that time was that all these kind of mysterious documents appeared that gave the answer that Saunier was looking for, or found documents about a bloodline. At that time, it was just the bloodline of the Merovingians, who are an ancient dynasty of France that were kind of the founders of the nation, and their survival. There was nothing in that about the Merovingians being linked to Jesus or anything. This is something that the authors of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail added to the story as it went
right.
on.
Kind of theorized
about. Diversion. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, they kind of theorized it. They couldn't even prove that. They just kind of offered that as a possible connection.
Yes, it's true, and you know, you can see how they You know, they've set out the reasons why they came to right. that conclusion, and they said where they were speculating and where they weren't. But in the end, we found that the core thing that they hung that story on about the Merovingian survival, which came from these documents of the 1960s, that was the misdirection. That was the thing that was put out to say, okay, Sonia was looking for documents, yes, and the documents were about this ancient dynasty. So all researchers then start going off on this trail looking for this dynasty and what its secret might be. But in fact, that was the false trail. That was to lead you away from what the secrets were. And strangely enough, the guy who is the main spokesman for the Priory of Zion now has since actually said that's what the purpose of all that stuff was to do. Then you could get in that tricky position. Okay, if the Priory of Zion have now confirmed what we're saying, does that mean we should believe them, or is that just another level of misinformation? You know?
Yeah. So who is the spokesperson right now for the Priory of Zion, and what kind of power do they really have?
Well, we have to say that there's no evidence, as far as we know, that there's more than sort of two members of the Priory of Zion.
I mean, okay,
you know,
two.
There's this idea that it's sort of thousands of very, you know, sort of highly placed people scattered around, you know, and according to the Da Vinci Code, there they all are in Scotland,
right.
wearing strange clothes and looking a bit
right.
strange. And you know, cropping up in Roslyn Chapel, and it's not like that at all, as far as we can tell. But then, of course, against you know us being able to discover anything, or anybody being able to discover anything about them, is the fact that if it's a secret society and very successful, then nobody will ever know anything about them because
right.
they're secret. You know,
right? You have to be a kind of a rummy secret society to be known in the first place.
Yes.
It's probably one of the best known secret societies in the world. That in itself has to tell us something.
Kind of contradictory. Yeah. I mean, when you say there's two people, maybe two people in the real Priory of Zion right now in sub-zero temperatures here in Minnesota in the United States, there are more than that standing in front of this building smoking cigarettes right now. I mean, that doesn't sound that much of an organization.
What we're really saying with the Priory of Zion as such, the organization that has that label and has the letterhead, you know, and all the badges and handshakes, that is a kind of shell. It's a front. It's a front for other societies that stand behind it. So those societies could do certain things in public without giving their existence away. So on the one hand, we're saying the Priory of Zion as such is really... it's just a mirage.
It's a joke.
You only need one guy to run the office, and that's it.
Right.
But behind that, there is a whole network of societies that you know are better known and have been around for you know 200 or 300 years. You know, we're not saying the private line is unimportant. In itself, it is. It's what is behind it that's important, and the reason that the private line was set up. It, you know, it was a front. It was to do certain things. It was originally created in the 50s for what were at that time purely political reasons.
Right.
It was a front.
Right-wing extreme nationalism, wasn't it?
Essentially, I mean, in the 50s, it was set up as part of a plan to, part of a network of groups that were trying to get General de Gaulle back into power in France, and they did so successfully. So it was kind of a cover for them at that time. Then it was kind of put on the shelf for a while, and in the 60s it was pulled out, and then it was used as this misinformation about the Merovingian dynasty. And now at that time, the Priory of Zion, before it was a kind of political society, now it comes back and it's got a more sort of esoteric, occult character.
Right.
And then they would put it back on the shelf, and then they would drag it out again later for another purpose. So it's this kind of all-purpose... it's a bit like the way intelligence agencies start
right.
front companies.
But it's very unromantic, isn't it? I mean, millions of people out there who've read about it in Dan Brown's book and have this wonderful idea that, you know, it goes back 1,000 years to the time of the Crusades. It's involved with, you know, Jesus
right.
and Mary Magdalene's bloodline. And it's, you know, this huge network of highly placed people. And in fact, you know, it kicked off in 1956 and it's about French politics.
Right. And now it's, you know, the priority of Zion are two guys living in their mom's basement, you know. I mean, it's not, but let's talk about that when we come back. The organizations, the real organizations then, that according to your work, are behind the Priory of Zion, these these real organizations, these real secret societies, which are much more elusive, and what you think they're really up to, and what feedback you got since the last time you were on the air with us on Coast to Coast AM that'll back up that theory next. This is Ian Punnett. Well, look forward to getting back to that conversation. Just want to give you a heads up, too, that on the blog tonight, I put some book recommendations. I have mentioned some of these before. Some of these I haven't. If you go to coasttocoastam.com and click onto my blog, you'll see at the end of that, there are a couple of books that I just thought might be interesting for you to consider for gift giving if you're looking for something in the holidays. One of them is called The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare. And it's about this swashbuckling rabbit. It's very cool. It was written and painted by a friend of mine, as is the book Disapproving Rabbits, coincidentally enough. Two different friends, two different books about rabbits. Disapproving Rabbits, though, is a funny book of captions and photographs of rabbit faces, which when you think about it, rabbits always look like they're disapproving of you, no matter what you're doing. They're giving you a funny look. And the book kind of makes that point well. And I also threw in there a link to all of the books by my aunt and uncle that I thought you might find interesting. They do obscure books about things that other people may never even have considered being book worthy. But that's my aunt and uncle for you. And they one of the books is about the early days of, I guess you could say, almost sort of the early days of NASCAR, or maybe the early days of drag racing, on the what they used to do on the beaches of Florida, and also some early days of aviation, if that interests you. You'll find out more at coasttocoastam.com, and then link up to the blog and scroll down a little bit, and you'll see some book recommendations. Hope you enjoy them. I know that you'll enjoy the rest of this conversation, because we're just getting to the part where we find out what Clive Prince and Lynn Picknett are up to after years of research into the Turin Shroud or the Priory of Sion and the Knights Templar. What's their latest? What feedback are they getting on their book from the real secret societies behind the Priory of Sion? We'll find out next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, the last time that Clive and Lynn were on the air with us was February 2006, and it was as the book was coming out. So you posited that the Priory of Sion was really kind of a contrived organization that was set up to take the scrutiny away from the real secret societies that are afoot both in Europe and around the world. So what are those secret societies, and how are they any more secret, if you know who they are, behind the Priory of Sion?
Well, I mean, they're organizations that are known about, but the thing is they do have higher grades of which you don't really know quite what they're up to. But just to very briefly explain, because it can become quite a complicated story if you condense it, but so I'll do the simple version. Obviously, in the book, we have time to go into this in a great more detail. But what happened was that we, as we were looking at the Priory of Sion and saying, well, this, the whole bloodline thing it's supposed to be about doesn't really work for various reasons, some of which are pure commonsensical ones. But we kept sort of thinking, oh, the whole thing must be a hoax. But we kept noticing that people connected with the Priory of Sion and its story, and this goes back to the early 1940s when it really started, all the way through to kind of the end of the 80s. When you look to some of these people, they're always connected with a certain little network of societies and Masonic orders. Giving all the names would be tedious, because mostly they actually have really boring names for what are actually quite very interesting and exciting societies. But the same thing, as we pieced this together and looked at these societies, we saw they all went back to the same root, and this root was a Masonic order that was founded in Germany, of all places, in around about 1750. And it was the first Masonic order that claimed that it was descended from the Knights Templar of the Middle Ages. Now, most people listening will now be very familiar with the idea that there's a connection between the medieval Templars and Freemasonry. But when this group, society first either formed itself or publicized itself, It said it had been underground for a long time. This was a completely new... These were the first people to say this, and this is about 1750. And so all the people we could connect with the Priory of Zion in modern times were part of societies descended from this order. It was a thing called the Strict Observance, which, again, doesn't sound that exciting, but these were, the first people to actually stand up and say, we are the Knights Templars, come back. And then after, we pieced this together over years of research and finding out little things here and there. And then the nice thing was that when we actually got down to the origins of this Strict Observance, we found out it organized itself not into lodges, but into chapters. And instead of a grand lodge, it has a high chapter. And its original chapter was actually called the Chapter of Zion. And also it's presided over not by grand masters, but what they call priors and grand priors. So it's divided into priories. So the original kind of grand lodge, if you like, of this organization was actually, it was called the Chapter of Zion, and it was headed by a prior. So we started with a modern Priory of Zion, which, we kind of looked on as a hoax. We followed this trail back, and I say this is over years of research, and we ended up back with, strange enough, a Priory of Zion right at the beginning of this story. And it's this organization. It changed a lot over the years. It changed its name at one time, and then it kind of splintered into other little groups. So it formed by today as a kind of network of groups. But everywhere we went with our research, we kept hitting this same network, and it always went back to the same core.
To a lot of people out there, I think a really fascinating thing is that time and time again, the individuals sort of historically involved with these various groups, and indeed some of the groups themselves, seem to have been obsessed with the idea of getting information through what we today would call channeling. No matter, whether they were sort of Masonic groups or not, or, but they were all esoteric in some way, and they seemed to... cutting-edge information that would move them on in the world, whether it's esoterically or occultly or spiritually or maybe even politically. But, for example, some groups in France that we sort of traced, they employed mediums or channelers, usually sort of servant girls, that kind of thing, and in order to get information from otherworldly entities. And this seems to be a bit of a theme. There are other themes, but it's fascinating that, behind all the pomp and circumstances, sort of the Masonic groups, is this sort of fairly basic idea for getting their hands on information that comes from the great beyond.
I want to know more about that, but any idea of how they used that information, presumably from the great beyond, to achieve the organization's goals? I mean, do we have any knowledge of events of history that were changed as a result of this real Priory of Zion?
Well, from the beginning, from the outset, the other kind of big theme, one is this kind of trying to get information from, as Lynn said, otherworldly entities, which at the time, again, it's something that would be so familiar to your listeners now, but at that time, this was kind of a really new venture. Let's try and get in touch with angels, entities, whatever, and get information. That's one thing. The other thing that came across is that right from the beginning, it was always about trying to get a United States of Europe. So on the one hand, you've got this very kind of mystical and esoteric thing of, gaining information through mystical means. On the other hand, you've got this very solid political agenda, and that's something that just cuts through, the whole story. Because we could then trace two things. One, earlier I was talking about Rennes Le Chateau and saying that the Saunier brothers seem to be looking for documents connected with the noble families of the area and other noble families from slightly further afield. These noble families were absolutely at the heart of these same secret societies. They founded some of the orders. So it's all tied up with the same thing. Now we're going on, this all started in about 1750. Now we're with the Saunier brothers. We're in sort of the late 1900s, but it's the same societies that are involved. And the other thing that we could do, which kind of started to get in slightly scary territory, when we kind of pursued this idea of, well, how do we get from this vague idea of maybe we should have a unified Europe through to what we now actually have today in the European Union, when we saw that every major initiative that a politician, normally a French politician, has taken that's advanced that agenda of getting an ever more integrated Europe is linked directly to one of the same societies. So, and this was something we, you know, these connections just came up. They weren't we weren't forcing them at all. So, is there a connection between the that agenda of the United States of Europe and advancing it, and the information that these they were drawing from these entities? The answer is probably, because the two, you know, the two sides of the story just mesh so well.
And of course, maybe your listeners are thinking, well, you know, it's French politics or it's European politics and it doesn't actually affect me. But actually, if these people achieve their ambition and there becomes the United States of Europe, and it's moving towards that at the moment, then, of course, it will be another power block in the world and it will affect everybody.
What would be different with the United States of Europe and the European Union? I mean, how would that actually effectively live out stronger or differently?
Well, I mean, it'll have I mean, now, you know, in Britain, we always joke about, you know, the power of Brussels, you know, the head of the centre of the European Union. But, you know, Brussels says this, Brussels says that, we have to kowtow to them. But I mean, only up to a certain point. But if there was the United States of Europe, it would literally mean a federal Europe in which, you know, the central government would have a say over all our lives. I mean, Britain has held out against, you know, the common currency, for example. It might not be possible to do that if there was an actual European Union, European state.
And, of course, it would certainly affect the kind of balance between, you know, Europe and the United States, for example. You know, as, you know, if Europe gets ever more integrated, you know, it's... you know, will emerge as a much stronger, you know, kind of power in the world.
Right.
So, you know, it does have implications, and it does. Every major initiative that's moved towards that, there's a direct connection between the politician that undertook that initiative and the same organisations that are behind the Priory of Zion. This goes up to and includes, for example, President Mitterrand, you know, who was president of France for many years. It's direct connection. It's not, you know, it's barely hidden. You know, the other thing I have to say, kind of, in France and in Europe generally, but particularly in France, the idea that, you know, hard-headed politicians can be involved in mystical and esoteric and Masonic goings-on doesn't seem as weird as it does to us in Britain, and probably to you in the United States. It's quite an accepted thing that, you know, politics and esoteric interests go hand in hand. You know, you almost kind of, in France, you say this to people, and they say, well, what's the big revelation about that? But to us in this, in you know, the English-speaking world, it does seem weird. But
actually, you notice that Clive differentiates between Britain and Europe. This is typical of Britain.
Well, and I think that this is interesting, of course, because there's a lot of conversations going on in the United States about a supposed American, North American union between Mexico, the United States, and Canada, that there would be a centralized government between the three. In your research, any hint that somehow this the same priority group could be involved in that kind of union?
We haven't come across that so much. There used to be, with the priory groups, until the mid-80s, there was quite a close tie-up between the European and mainly French side of it and the American side, and there seemed to be a kind of bit of a falling out or parting of the ways in the 1980s, probably for just purely practical reasons. You know, end of the Cold War meant that, you know, Europe politically wasn't so dependent on the United States and NATO and things like that. So, you know, as circumstances changed, it seems that the alignments changed. You know, who knows what's going on? You know, those ideas in North America could stem from similar groups, because there is a whole American side to this. One of the groups that's involved in this was very strong in Mexico at one point. I'll just kind of throw that in. I don't know if that is part of that, because yeah, we haven't researched that side of it to the same degree as we have the European side. But it could be. It could be those, you know, the same idea.
I have to say that, you know, history, or the potential of history, can be quite astonishing. When we were researching for... We went off and did three books, more or less, about the World War II with another author, the late Stephen Pryor. And, you know, it's surprising what you dig up just researching sort of the last century's history, really. For example, there was at one point an idea mooted that Britain merged with France. I mean, ooh, that wouldn't have worked, would it? Or at one point in the 1920s, there was a serious... it was seriously, you know, teetering on the brink of actual out-and-out war between the United States and Britain. You know, all these things just actually happened. So the idea that, you know, there could be a Mexico states and Canada sort of emerging is perhaps not so, you know, off the wall.
Well, tell me about this time when the U.S. and Britain were almost at war. What is that about?
It was really in the 1920s, kind of as the implications of what had happened in World War One were kind of sinking in around the world. You know, all the different powers are kind of jostling for power. The British Empire is losing its, losing a lot of its influence and power. America is rising as an international power because of World War One. And really, it was an economic kind of challenge between the two, that it was recognized that if the two countries carried on the way they were doing, inevitably they would start to get into conflict in different areas of the world, purely over trade and things, but it would escalate. And the important clue was that we're talking about 1928, 1929, that politicians on both sides of the Atlantic were kept saying to the people, there is no possibility of war between our countries. And as people at the time pointed out, when politicians start denying something, you need to start thinking about why they're denying it.
Right.
And Winston Churchill himself, I think in 29, Winston Churchill was one of the people who actually went on record and said, look, we keep talking about war between our two countries as being unthinkable, was the word, but we actually really know that this isn't true. And what actually headed it off at the time, there was some big economic conferences in which, you know, the world was basically divided up between not just Britain and France, but, you know, various trade agreements. But it was a real possibility, and it's one of those things that, you know, you look back over history now and you just don't even see a glimmering of that. But if you go back to the newspapers of the late 1920s and the, you know, the political journals of the 1920s, you see that's what people were talking about. You know, it's that if there was going to be a conflict at that time, it was actually going to be, say, between the United States and the United Kingdom. It
right.
didn't happen, of course. Yeah.
No,
thankfully.
Yeah. and yet some of the stuff you're talking about with this priori, the real priori of Sion, well, the what did you call it, the chapter of Sion? What was it called?
It began with the chapter of Sion. But,
right.
You know.
So, but the real organization behind the front organization did kind of hint at some of the threads that were pulled on later on by Adolf Hitler and the Nazis as they were building their Teutonic Knights myths for the Third Reich. And I want to come back and I want to ask you about that. And then I want to get to you. I got to just find out what you all are up to, because I know you're always doing interesting research. And
yeah.
And what more has come up for you on your Turin Shroud research and some of your other Knights Templar work? We'll get down to it coming up next, and then it'll be a while, but we'll get your calls in too for Clive Prince and Lynn Picknett coming up. We'll talk about the things that have come across their desk since they were last on. Back a year ago or so, 2 years ago in February, coming up. Also, a reminder, too, I'll be doing open lines again this coming Friday night. Enjoyed it and hope that George is enjoying a nice long weekend. He's earned it on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.